I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Many cities are banking their future on the promise of logistics, the industry devoted to moving stuff from the maker to the market. While the industry has grown more sophisticated with information and technology, success still depends on transportation. Rob Hoffman, the former director of business development for World Business Chicago and a specialist in trade, is with us to talk about the state of transportation and how it affects a major growth industry in the U.S. We'll also talk to Sarah Rogers about the Urban Academies of Broward County in South Florida, a recent Harvard Innovations in Government Award winner. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Rob Hoffman was until recently Director of Business Development at World Business Chicago, specializing in the attraction and retention of the manufacturing sector and related support industries, including distribution, air, land, and water transportation. Prior to joining World Business Chicago, Rob led the industrial marketing and sales practice at the Chicago Manufacturing Center. He was a career diplomat with the British Foreign Service for 25 years, where he served in 17 different countries. He specialized in trade matters, assisting British firms to export and or invest in the local market. Rob, when you say transportation, most of us think about how we get to work every day. We rarely think about the transportation of goods within the U.S. and to the U.S. We know our commute times are increasing as individual drivers. What's happening to the movement of goods in the U.S.?
Well, it's all down to globalization. It's on the increase and has been really for the last 8 to 10 years. In the last 5 years, freight, and in particular the ubiquitous containers that you see on the trains and the trucks, though that's called intermodal. Intermodal basically means that it moves between different types of transportation, i.e. ship to a truck, to a train, things like that. The container revolutionized that business, and that traffic, particularly from the Far East and China, is growing at about 8 to 10% a year and has been for the last 5 years or more. Projections out for the next 20 years show that it will continue to increase at least that level, if not more, as we import more of our physical goods and move more and more into a service-type economy.
Is our transportation network prepared to handle that level of increase?
There's a one-word answer for that: no. As somebody put it, particularly with effect to the ports and railroads, that we are essentially attempting to run a 21st century supply chain on a 19th century infrastructure. None of our ports or railroads were built for containers, and indeed many, in some ways neither were our roads or our factories or distribution points. Those have changed quicker than the others, but they all have problems of being outmoded in many instances for the way goods are transported these days, particularly in the older parts of the U.S.
You told me recently that shipping is changing so dramatically in terms of the size of ships that, of course, that has an effect all the way down the supply chain. And in particular, it's affecting rail in a way that is dramatic. Describe those changes.
Well, if you take the old, 19th century version of a port, which is basically the ship ties up to a quay side and is offloaded from the side. So all our ports, we haven't built a new port in decades, are geared towards that type of unloading. If you were to build a port today that would handle containers, you would build that very differently. In other words, you would build really like parking, horizontal parking, so that instead of tying up from the side, the ship would go in face first, and you could use cranes on either sides to offload it straight onto a railway, and off it would go. And indeed, this is what the Chinese are doing, because they are building new ports. So that's the first thing, that the ports were not built to maximize the efficiency of offloading modern ships. Like everything else, economies of scale come into operation with shipping, as with anywhere else. We saw it with the tanker industry, where, you know, they went from 100,000 barrels of oil to 150 to 200,000 to millions, etc. The same with containers. The average size of a container ship on the high seas at the moment is between the more modern ships of 6,000 containers, or 20-foot TEUs, as they're called. Ships are rolling off out of the shipyards at the moment at 8,000, 9,000 TEUs, and other ships are being built of 12,000, and plans are out there for 15,000. Those ships are the equivalent length of 3 to 4 football fields, American football, not soccer. So what you've got is, you know, significantly larger ships, and as a consequence, those ships draft, in other words, the depth under the hull that needs to be there to allow the ship to pass, is getting deeper and deeper. Most U.S. ports have a navigation channel of about 45 feet or less. Many of them are river estuary ports, so they have to be dredged on a regular basis, and that costs a lot of money. The big ships on plans at the moment will be 60, 65 feet in draft. And although it's perfectly technically possible to dredge a 20-foot additional channel, the problem is these are river estuary ports and they're constantly filling up. So what is happening is that on the one hand, we have this growth of the actual overall number of containers, and they're coming and will do over the next 20 years on bigger and bigger ships, but de facto we'll only be able to handle them in fewer and fewer ports. There are ways around that, but the fact is that the dredging costs have to be passed on, so the port fees are high, and we all know, basically, common sense will direct the shippers to where do I don't have to pay that sort of fee. And on the East Coast, that will probably come down to there are only really two deep water ports over there. That's Norfolk, Virginia, where the aircraft carriers are based on the East Coast, and they're based there because it's deep water, and in Halifax in Nova Scotia, which has a deep water port. Some others are marginal, may depend, but de facto, in my opinion, I think they will just, you'll get this vectoring of ships coming in. And on the West Coast, we're a bit better off. There's a port in Mexico that is being built at the moment that is deep water. Long Beach, Los Angeles, which is the main entry port for Pacific Rim goods, and Prince Rupert Island and Seattle. So that's coming in there. There is also the problem of the demand for the goods is where the bulk of the population live, which is still east of the Mississippi. So you can bring it into Los Angeles, Long Beach, but then you have to ship it to where the population is. An alternative has always been the Panama Canal, that you push it through the Panama Canal and bring it round. The problem is that the Panama Canal is getting more and more constrained on the size of ships it can take. They've recently announced a $10 billion expansion. But even so, ships already on the water, the 8,000 container ships, will not be able to fit through the Panama Canal, even when it's finished with its expansion.
play that out for me, the issue of rail and truck moving through the U.S., and you say that's 19th century infrastructure as well. So are we – I mean, clearly there's a problem. There's a mismatch, which seems to me either – it can be solved in two ways. I mean, one, you build more infrastructure, or two, you begin to reduce your need for manufactured goods coming in from other places, coming into these ports. So what do you see as the direction we're going to take?
Well, of course, it's a lot easier to see what you need to do. It's another matter to actually pay for it. The big issue is that for 40 of the last 50 years, if not longer, the railroads have been in a, and particularly the Class 1 railroads, which are the, there are six of them, they're the main freight railroads, that's all they do. Amtrak just handles passengers, but the big six Class 1 railroads, two from Canada and four out of the US, are the main freight carriers. In the sense of tons carried, but at, you know, when it all comes down to it, they only carry about 20-23% of actual freight. But in terms of the containers that we're talking about, they're usually the first intermodal transfer. It comes off the ship, unloaded at the port, loaded on a train. And that train is then shipped to other parts where it's transferred in the different areas. And in fact, that's where Chicago comes in, because Chicago is the only point in North America where all six Class 1 railroads intersect. So the railroads have been retrenching for a long time. So they were not investing in their infrastructure at all. Quite the contrary, they were getting rid of as much as they possibly were. They weren't hiring for years. And the intermodal growth, to an extent, caught them by surprise. And it's a whole new business for them. And they weren't particularly keen on it either at first, although they swear this is not true, but it is true, that they really were dragged kicking and screaming into the container business. Up until then, they basically were bulk cargo carriers. And it was very easy. You ran a train into a coal mine, you loaded it up with coal, and you took it however many hundreds of miles to a power station, but the whole load was offloaded at the power station. You turn around, went back to the coal mine, filled up again. Same thing with the grain exports. You know, pick it up, take it to a single point, and that's the end of it. Of course, containers are different. I mean, if coming from the West Coast, they largely run what's called double stack trains, and that's two containers on a flatbed. To about the maximum that the trains can cope with is 200 flatbeds with two containers each, so that's 400 containers. Now, there aren't a lot of bridges and all the rest of it out west. It's, you know, a lot easier to do that. They can't do the same on the East Coast because it's a much more built-up area and the infrastructure is much older. And there are large areas where you simply can't run double-stack trains. You can only run single-stack because the road bridges and all the other infrastructure was not built to have something of that height pass underneath them. They are doing something about it, but you can imagine how many hundreds of bridges we are talking about. So that's one issue. The issue of even the existing infrastructure that you've got, you can't use it to the maximum benefit because other elements of infrastructure have not been modernized. At the same time, the pace of globalization was going faster than many people anticipated. You can't blame the railroads for not foreseeing it when the vast majority of American manufacturers didn't see it either. And so you've got this tremendous growth going on in containers, and it's happening very quickly within this particular context when they normally could plan 3 or 4 years out and in front and all the rest of it. And they weren't geared to it. They were not able to secure funding to build what one would call speculative additions to their stuff. You know, and at the time when the markets were all raging, the last thing anybody wanted to do was to to fund capital-intensive stuff. They get much quicker returns on their money going into the dot-coms and all that sort of thing. So the guys had hard time borrowing money to do this stuff and hard time getting people to believe them, even when they finally believed it, that this was not a flash in the pan, that this was going to be a sustained growth period for them. And if you look at railroad, freight railroad shares in the last 3 or 4 years, they've done phenomenally well. If you compare them with the last 50, it's amazing how they've come back.
Rob, you've done a great job of setting up the problem, but what's the solution?
Therein lies the $64,000 question. Well, it comes down to money. And where does that money come from? The fact is that both the federal government and the state governments have failed to set aside sufficient funds for infrastructure of all types, or have not passed necessary legislation to allow private sector companies to come in, be it power transmission lines, be it roads, be it rail, be it transit, airports, whatever. And the problem is, even aside before the Iraq war and the amount of money that's costing, was a problem that simply not enough funds are being set aside to maintain the existing infrastructure, never mind expand it. With the Iraq war, with the baby boomers and the retirement issues that go with that, both in terms of healthcare, pensions, social security, national defense, etc., transportation infrastructure or any form of infrastructure comes very low down on the priority of Congress or state legislatures. One can see it here in Illinois, with the transit clearly in severe financial problems, and yet the legislative leaders from the governor down don't have it anywhere in their top 10. So what do we do? Well, one way is to get a whole lot more out of our infrastructure than we currently do, and that is, of course, use technology, and that can be relatively cheap. But the fact remains we need to expand our transport infrastructure. And the only way really that I can see where this can be achieved is by tapping private money. There's a great deal of opposition to this when it comes to selling of what's seen as public assets, although they are going for lease. De facto, they're being sold. While I think that's a good idea, is if you take, for example, the Indiana Tollway, which was sold recently or leased for $3 billion, there the problem was a complete lack of maintenance and upkeep because no politician would take a decision to raise the toll rate. We could generate more money through taxes, gas taxes, but that seems to be the third rail in politics, that nobody is willing to see a significant rise in the gas tax in order to pay for the infrastructure. And in part, that's because the populace don't trust the politicians. They hear that the taxes are going slowly to improve infrastructure, but what happens in many areas is that that tax money gets diverted into general funds and operating funds and doesn't go for the purpose for which it was supposedly intended. There are things like building new toll roads where the toll is used to pay for that. There can be transit fees on the freight side, for example. You could fund a major improvement in infrastructure in Chicago. In Chicago, which has a plan to revitalize and improve its freight rail system, which would, at least in the first phase, would cost about $1.5 billion. The last federal transportation bill, where they were looking for $900 million from the federal authorities, we got 100 million. And we're the railway hub of North America. At the moment, there's no alternative funding and severe opposition from both shippers and the railways and the truckers to any proposal that you could draw a sort of electronic boundary around the Chicago Rail Transit area and charge a transit fee. Every container that came in on a rail or by truck or by water would pay a transit fee, and that money would then be used to fund bond acquisition to achieve the desired results. That proposal's going nowhere, although quite frankly I can't see how this is ever going to be done unless we adapt more radical approaches to the funding of these things. And so the issue, as so often, comes down to money. And without a ready access to significant funds, then I don't know what we're going to do.
Rob Hoffman was Director of Business Development for World Business Chicago. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetta's and assistant editor, Nate Berg.
Fuel-efficient cars are great for drivers who are tired of spending lots of money at the gas station. They're also not too bad for the environment, but they are really bad if you're the Federal Highway Administration. The FHA is estimating that by 2009, increased fuel efficiency will have such a negative effect on its income from gas taxes that federal highway coffers will be $21 billion short of what's needed just to keep up existing roads. The Wall Street Journal reports that states are scrambling to find ways to deal with this anticipated budget pinch. Oregon, for example, has just ended a one-year pilot program that used global positioning systems to keep track of drivers' mileage and charge them a flat rate of 1.2 cents per mile. Other states are considering similar programs, but many people are wary about the government always knowing where they're driving. And while it's going to be harder for funding to keep up with American road demand, it is the roads themselves that can't seem to keep up in Atlanta, where an urban population boom is putting more and more people on the city's old streets. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports that traffic has gotten significantly worse in recent years, as many of the people who moved out of the city in the 70s and 80s are returning. The state is hesitant to provide transportation funding, so the city is taking the lead on funding some projects. It has even created a new transportation planning division and is in the process of creating a comprehensive transportation plan, the first in Atlanta's history. And finally, if you think your house or apartment is small, a designer in Munich has been producing a line of homes that are just 76 square feet. That's right, 76. Wired magazine takes readers on an appropriately short tour of one of these homes, which were all designed by Richard Horden of the Technical University of Munich. Each home is delivered to the buyer in a complete package, equipped with two double beds, seating for five, a kitchen, storage space, a toilet, and a shower. Horden also has plans to install wind turbines and solar panels to make these cubic mini-homes self-sustaining. The homes are currently only available in Europe, but if you're there and you've got $96,000, you could be one of the smallest homeowners in the world. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for PlanEdison.com. After a short break, we'll talk with Sarah Rogers, winner of Harvard's Innovations in Government Award for her work to improve urban education in Broward County. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Inspiration for ways to improve our cities and communities can come from many sources. We've talked with urban leaders, designers, corporate CEOs, planners, architects, and others about innovative responses to the challenges so many of our nation's cities face. This week, Business Week magazine's innovation and design writer, Rena Janna, weighs in with what she sees as on the cutting edge of business and technology and how these ideas may influence the smart city.
You've heard the hype surrounding Second Life. It's the online 3D parallel universe that's the darling of corporations ranging from Toyota to IBM. These companies have been experimenting with selling digital goods and conducting meetings among avatars within Second Life. It's where 5 million virtual residents around the world spend real dollars for digital real estate. They also buy pixelated cars and clothing that they design and sell themselves. Or they customize and purchase goods from companies such as Reebok and American Apparel. It's also an online environment that's become notorious for vandalism and adult-themed content, not to mention technical glitches and hackers. But Second Life isn't the only virtual community worth paying attention to. This year, a number of new alternatives are starting to crop up. They promise more secure and specialized environments for consumers and corporations alike. One virtual world that we've been paying attention to is Kineva. It's currently free in an open beta. The company wants to attract large mainstream audiences, and it has really easy-to-use design tools, graphics that load quickly, and safety features that keep out cybercriminals. In real estate terms, Kineva is the digital suburbs to Second Life's more urban environment. Currently, Kineva has 150,000-plus beta users. That's up from 115,000 in March 2007 and nearly double the 80,000 users in December 2006. Kineva is generating some early buzz thanks to its focus on social networking and security. Similar to MySpace, Kineva allows for friend requests, comments, email among members, and profiles via a two-dimensional customized web page. And like Second Life, Kineva also offers animated 3D characters that users design and manipulate through on-screen environments in real time. So users can also upload music, images, and video and play streaming media within these virtual environments. But what sets Kineva apart is its current level of supervision from its parent company. The entire virtual world is aesthetically controlled by Kineva's software. What that means is that users can't design their own buildings, clothing, or vehicles from scratch. And they can't hire a developer to design virtual products. In Kineva, people currently choose an existing design for their virtual apartment and human avatars. But in Second Life, residents can buy islands and create wacky avatars and environments. So the question we've been asking is how Kineva is going to make money. One model the company has shared with us is brand sponsorship of digital products. Kineva may also charge users who want to upgrade the free apartments, furniture, and avatar clothes. And then there's a licensing opportunity. Currently, Kineva gives away its software to companies, and there's been about 40,000 downloads to date. So it's no surprise that Kineva offers a secure environment. It's the brainchild of Christopher Klaus, who founded Internet Security Systems in 1994 while a student at Georgia Tech. IBM bought the computer security company for $1.3 billion last year, providing Klaus with plenty of seed capital for Kineva. So Kineva isn't the first company to offer an alternative to Second Life that merges social networking with a 3D online universe. There's Cyworld, which originated in Korea, but now has an American version. Its graphics are more cartoon-like than those of Kineva or Second Life. Cyworld is basically a social networking site that also offers online environments that users outfit with avatars and digital furniture and goods. Some of them are co-branded with popular TV shows, such as Bravo Network's Top Design. And Linden Lab, the company behind Second Life, is constantly launching new applications to keep fans loyal to the virtual world. For example, Linden Lab recently introduced a sound feature that allows Second Life residents' voices to be heard within the virtual world. Kineva is still a work in progress. Although the 3D avatars look eerily similar to those in Second Life, some of the animation isn't quite as sophisticated. For example, avatars can't sit in a chair in the current beta version. But Klaus says Kineva should be finished with an animation system upgrade by early May. Other 3D virtual worlds we're looking into include Tixio, a maker of corporate virtual world software used by customers including defense contractor Raytheon. In Tixio, users conduct meetings among executive avatars in a secure environment only available to invited guests. Another is Quack, a startup that also offers avatar-based online corporate offices and meeting rooms. Quack uses engaging light, music, and color cues to highlight documents being discussed. To find a file, you simply say its name, like Business Week article on new virtual worlds. And then avatars appear in a corresponding 3D room. And another virtual world that's worth checking out is Multiverse. It's best for small businesses and individuals interested in creating their own virtual worlds without much financial commitment. Its tools are available for free. But if you create digital goods, such as clothing, and sell them to other avatars, Multiverse takes a 10% cut of your profits. So clearly, Second Life isn't alone in the ever-expanding realm of virtual worlds. There's a second wave of 3D parallel universes out there for a variety of corporate and consumer experimentation, just waiting to be visited.
Rena Janna is innovation and design writer for Business Week. You're listening to Smart City. Sarah Rogers is coordinator of the Urban Academies of Broward County. She's a lifetime educator, having served as a math teacher, assistant principal, and principal for 30 years. She was selected by Brown University as one of the original Annenberg Fellows, and when she retired in 1998, she was principal of Florida's largest high school, Flanagan, with a student body of more than 5,000. In 2000, Sarah was asked by the Broward County Educational Consortium to run the urban academies in the county. Since that time, the program has expanded from 4 to 17 locations and from a concentration on elementary schools to the full spectrum of K through 12. Sarah, nationally, less than 60% of new teachers remain in urban schools for more than 3 years. Why is the dropout rate for teachers so high?
I think teachers, young people particularly, who come into education don't understand the problems that they might encounter. And I don't mean problems in a negative way. They are just not familiar with the culture that they're dealing with, the classroom management issues, the sorts of things that may be very different from the way the typical college student was raised. You know, students no longer are quietly sitting in rows and just listening to everything the teacher has to say. So it's a very difficult thing, particularly in the first 3 years.
Is it not something that they learn as they prepare to be teachers?
I think as they prepare to be teachers, their content knowledge is absolutely wonderful. But in most instances, those other pieces, the classroom management piece, the culturalization, that sort of thing is theoretical, and they don't get as much practice as they need to be able to step right up to the plate when they take that first job.
So how do the Urban Academies of Broward County address the problem?
Well, we work in three different ways. We have three distinct programs. One program allows us, with our partner higher eds, just to go straight to those education courses, be it the beginning, Ed 101, all the way through practicums and internships. And we have those college students in our classrooms of schools that previously were very hard to staff. We give them the practical help as they go through their entire major in education. So they're not surprised when they begin to teach in our classrooms, and we have great support for them. The second piece of what we do is we recruit students as early as eighth grade to take a 4-credit through high school rigorous program. And when they graduate from one of our high schools, and we have 5 designated ones in our district, they have already earned their intro to education credit, and we promise them a debt-free college education if they come back and teach for us. So they hit college having more experience than most college students. And the third thing we do is work with the teachers, the practicing teachers who are presently in our schools, to make sure their skills are the best so that they are modeling the best practice for people who aspire to become teachers.
Interesting set of programs. Let me ask you about your recruitment of students in eighth grade and the courses that they're taking in high school to prepare them to be teachers. That's an interesting bargain that you're making with them. What kinds of students are you attracting?
We're real proud of the students we've attracted. We have really recruited students who probably had no idea that they were going to college and really didn't understand that they might be good teachers. We have many, in fact, most first generation to go to college students. We have a high number of minority students, and we have been working very diligently at attracting young men, because men in education, particularly in elementary schools, are a great minority.
And does that identification with the eventual students that they're going to teach help them be better teachers?
They're loyal to their communities. They know that perhaps they even went to the elementary school that they're doing some of their practical experiences in. They know that those students deserve the very best teachers. And so they build their loyalty as they go. Also, they are students who see becoming a teacher as a really worthwhile career. You know, in America, there are a lot of people who do not honor the profession of teaching. And, of course, none of us would be anywhere if we didn't have a teacher somewhere along the line that inspired us and taught us what we needed to know to become whatever we've become.
And you say that you work with practicing teachers who model the behaviors that you want to see in new teachers. What would be those two or three things that you would focus on with practicing teachers in terms of the model behavior you're seeking?
Well, with our practicing teachers, we do a lot of work around making sure that their practices are current, meaning are they doing the most recent and valid and data-driven reading, writing, and math programs, and are they really competent in it? Secondly, we support them in learning additional ways to engage their students in learning, whether it be some of the newest research on classroom management or behavior management. And also, I have five staff members who not only model for the aspiring teachers, but they're very willing to go in and model for the teachers that are in those classrooms. And the staff members that I have all been very successful teachers in what were known as hard to staff schools.
And how does one engage students today in learning?
There has to be relevance, first of all. Every child is proud to learn when they know there's a reason that they're learning. So as long as what they're learning is relevant and teachers are able to relate it to the real world, then they become very engaged. Secondly, students need hands-on sorts of activities. They are so active outside of school, they need to remain active in school. And the third thing is we try to use a great deal of technology, because we know that technology is something that particularly our students don't have at home. So we try to integrate that into their learning as well.
Is the school system now doing something different through urban academies to increase the length of service by teachers?
Well, they're looking at expanding our program. What they understand is the school system understands that with the right coaching and with the right support, teachers can be successful in schools that, very frankly, used to be considered places of punishment for teachers. So the school system has supported us greatly. In fact, they're looking at expansion. And I can't tell you how many principals call me in a week saying, how do I become an urban academy?
You were specifically set up to address the length of service by teachers. In other words, you don't want teachers coming into the profession and leaving within 3 years. Is quality of service, quality of teaching, if you will, inextricably linked to the length of service? In other words, if a teacher feels more successful and is more successful and sees the result in the student's performance of that success, are they likely to stay longer?
Absolutely. Teachers almost always follow strong leadership. They're really attracted by strong leadership in a school. They're attracted by the success of their students. And they're attracted by very, very simple rewards, which are oftentimes as simple as thank you for the great job you're doing, instead of being underappreciated. And so we found that some of those things work as well. And secondly, they're happier if they're competent in their jobs. And my job and the job of my staff members is to make sure that we do everything we can to make them competent. Once they feel competent, then they progress so much more quickly than, you know, young teachers or beginning teachers who haven't had the kind of experience and support we're able to give them.
Mm-hmm. Is it any more expensive to prepare teachers in this way rather than in the traditional fashion?
It may be a little bit more expensive. It's money well spent, because there are several national studies going on right now that haven't come up with final conclusions. But the conclusion is, we assume the conclusion is going to be, to replace a teacher is much more expensive than the amount of money we spend on preparing them properly and getting them ready for their assignments. When a teacher finishes 2 years and then decides to leave the system, there's a great deal of money spent in recruiting somebody to take that person's place, in giving them initial training, in everything that's involved. And so there are some national studies looking at what happens with teacher turnover and what the added expense is at that.
Sarah, over a 4-year degree program, how much of that time would a would-be or prospective teacher spend in an actual classroom?
Their freshman year, they have 2 courses that require 15 hours of observation. So that would be 30 hours there. And then during their sophomore and junior years, they have several courses that require anywhere from 60 to 90 hours. And then finally, their senior year, they're in a classroom for a semester, whatever a university defines that to be. Usually they're with us about 75 days. But the one thing that we do is, the minute we find them as freshmen, my staff will sign them up as volunteers at our schools. And once we hook them, they spend a lot more time than whatever is required.
So those requirements you just described to me are the requirements that exist in universities today without urban academies. Is that correct?
Yes. They exist in universities. But the difference between what a regular program would do and what ours does is, ours has continuity of service in the same or very similar schools.
Ah.
Where in a traditional program, you might go to 6 or 7 different schools with no continuity.
Are you able in urban academies to choose the school leaders you want to work with? In other words, when you choose a school to work with, I assume you're making a judgment about the school leadership and the classroom leadership.
Yes, I meet with, if we add a school to our program, I meet with the district senior management, and we look at the potential in that school. We look at the leadership. We look at the type of faculty that's there at that moment. We look at the need, and we look at the acceptance. We always go in and talk with those practicing teachers in those schools to make sure they're willing to take on this mentorship and coaching, and that they're willing to learn new ways to do things. So, you know, it's sort of like aligning the stars when you select a school.
What have you learned through this program that you think all school systems should know?
Well, I think we've learned that all teachers want to do well. and they want their students to do well. And sometimes left to their own devices without the right coaching and mentoring, they just don't know how. And I don't think anyone signs up as, you know, a starry-eyed little right out of college beginning teacher thinking that they're not going to be a success. But we're there to make sure they know before they begin at that point how to handle the things that just might make a difference in even the first 6 months of teaching.
And when other school systems come to you and say, Sarah, how do we get some of that magic? What do you tell them?
I tell them that the most important thing is that you work and develop your partnerships. The most important thing that we have going for us is that we have four major university partners, and there's no jealousy among our university partners. We have Florida Atlantic University, Nova Southeastern, Broward Community College, and Berry University. So we have two privates, a large public higher ed, and then a large public community college. And those partnerships make all the difference in the world. The presidents of those universities sit at the table with the superintendent of schools, and of course I'm always there as a staff member, and they talk about only education issues. They make schools and education as important as the law school or the med school or any of their others. And that makes all the difference in the world into how we are able to proceed.
Sarah, congratulations on winning the Innovations in American Government Award, and I thank you for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, you're very welcome.
Sarah Rogers is coordinator of the Urban Academies of Broward County.
City View's commentator Walker Smith says in life, it's hard to find the right balance of what we can't live with and what we can't live without.
There is an old trick that revolutionary movements have used for centuries to topple the regimes they oppose. The trick is to provoke the establishment into overreacting to revolutionary provocations, because an excessive reaction often galvanizes broader resistance by undermining the moral authority of the established order. Sometimes this trick works just by accident. For example, when Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and the Washington Post in 1971, he was just trying to get the facts about the war into the public domain. He wasn't trying to provoke the Nixon administration into overreacting, but that's exactly what happened. President Nixon responded by setting up the infamous White House plumbers to plug information leaks. But in their zeal, the plumbers did many questionable things, including bugging the offices of the Democratic Party, a bit of political espionage that led directly to Watergate and the eventual resignation of President Nixon. Many revolutionaries would contend that it is only in response to extreme provocations that the true nature of a regime is revealed. And perhaps there is some truth in this notion. For only in trying times do we see which liberties are considered so precious that they are untouchable even when things are at their worst. Of course, revolutionary movements have the advantage of not having to govern, so they aren't saddled with the burden of keeping order while responding to threats and dangers. Indeed, revolutionaries can use both the freedoms and the restrictions of government to their advantage. They can use the freedoms to move about and sow dissent, and then later trumpet their "I told you so's" when the government decides to crack down with restrictions and force. Responding to provocations can be a tough dilemma. We even wrestle with this sort of choice between bad and worse in our personal lives. We know that our children are going to misbehave, yet we are not going to fence them in like cattle. We know that a few employees and coworkers will flaunt company policies, yet we don't want to lose contributing team members just for the sake of protocol. We know that some people make a point of speeding, breaking in line, or talking out of turn, yet we also know that the only ways to stop them are unacceptably intrusive and domineering. In every aspect of our lives, we know how hard it is to find the right balance of what we can't live with and what we can't live without. Politically, this quandary is felt most keenly in democracies. No society can tolerate violence and discord. Yet in a democracy, a repressive response is nothing but a Pyrrhic victory. Because when democracies respond to threats against the social order in ways that impinge upon fundamental rights, liberties, and freedoms, the essence of democracy itself is jeopardized. Something elemental is lost. Something essential to the very definition of democratic society is sacrificed. The enemies of democracy win at least a small victory at home, if not a much bigger victory in the court of world opinion, by being able to claim that when push comes to shove, democracies are, in truth, no better than the most despotic dictatorships. Recent events have put America in exactly this situation. Fundamental extremists who believe that American values are sinful and corrupt pose a threat to the safety and well-being of American citizens, forcing us to ask ourselves how much we are willing to curtail certain rights and liberties in order to increase our vigilance and security. Over the past 2 years, we have learned that there are no easy answers to this question. But there are better and worse ways to think about what we must do and how we should proceed. Broadly speaking, we must guard against overreaction, for this is exactly the response that our enemies are hoping to provoke. As we move security to the top of our priority list, we must make it stand alongside liberty, not displace it. We must show that in a democracy, it is possible to balance the competing needs of safety and freedom. We must show that in a democracy, unlike an authoritarian fundamentalist state, we always try to do more than simply call upon our reserves of power and force. The strength of the American character is as much a strong heart as an iron fist. A balanced response will show that America is willing and able to do the hardest thing of all, keeping our society free, even as we keep it safe. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders whose next national meeting is May 1st through 2nd in San Jose to discuss turning urban amenities into urban assets. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.